everyone. This is Luke Caverly, and you're listening to the Divided Kingdom radio show. Well, here it is, coming up on the 250th anniversary of American independence. This very Saturday, we will be celebrating July 4th, 250 years after the Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia. So I thought I'd put a few things in related to that, as well as some other articles today. This is a Christian program, and we have news articles. If you'd like to contact me, you can write to me at Lou, L-O-U, Caverly, C-A-V-E-R-L-Y, Post Office Box 28 in Bethlehem, Maryland, and the zip code is 21609. And I'll repeat that a little later if you didn't have a writing instrument handy. Well, first, we have an unfortunate article, but these things happen. From Fox News, Burgum, that is Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, vows full prosecution after vandals carved 350-foot gash into Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool. This is by Taylor Penley of Fox News, published June 28, 2026. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum vowed full prosecution Saturday of vandals who allegedly slashed a 350-foot-long gash into the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool and defaced the area with a slew of anti-Trump graffiti. Secretary Burgum said, quote, "When people are attacking it," meaning the reflecting pool, "it is like an attack on our country. These are our most sacred monuments, and they," the perpetrators, "are going to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law," unquote. Burgum discussed the damage and the Trump administration's response to it during a Friends, make that Fox and Friends, weekend appearance, revealing that authorities have made 7 arrests, issued multiple citations, and filed 18 police reports in connection with the vandalism. According to Burgum, the damage extended roughly 350 feet along the pole's industrial rubber liner, which he said investigators believe was cut with a box cutter. Images show some of the anti-Trump markings the vandals left behind, including the numbers 8647, interpreted by many as a call to violence or a call to remove the president from office. And by the way, the article shows some good pictures here that you might want to check out if you have the access to the internet. The reflecting pool is part of the 1922 Lincoln Memorial, Burgum said. And he said, when people are using box cutters to do vandalism on this thing, it's the same as if they were throwing paint on Lincoln's statue in the eyes of the law, unquote. President Donald Trump addressed the vandalism on Friday, saying the newly restored reflecting pool had been deliberately targeted. Trump said, quote, "They ripped a scar 350 feet long through the side of the reflecting pool. These are the people we're dealing with. These are people that want to destroy our country," unquote. Burgum said the vandalism came despite a concerted effort by the Trump administration to restore and beautify the nation's capital ahead of the upcoming celebration of America's 250th anniversary. He said more than 50 parks and circles have been restored, 48 monuments repaired, 22 fountains returned to service, and roughly 1,700 lights fixed throughout the National Mall. Fencing now surrounds the reflecting pool amid an investigation into damage. Burgum said the fence was installed in part to protect the pool and in preparation for July 4th festivities, which will include fireworks on either side of the monument. Well, and that ends the article. That's a sad commentary on what certain nuts or just evil people will do. And I think if they catch them, they should absolutely prosecute them to the fullest extent possible. And this again was in Fox News, June 28th, And the beginning says, or the headline says, Bergman vows full prosecution, etc. Okay. On a happy note, you may have seen on the TV or heard on the radio that a lot of the foreign tourists and World Cup people are amazed by what they see in America. So here we are from WorldNet Daily. It's called The Land of the Free. World Cup tourists see what too many Americans have forgotten. This is by Josh Hammer, and he is, I believe, connected with Newsweek. Yeah, he's the senior editor-at-large of Newsweek. And this was dated June 26, 2026. Americans are routinely told that our nation is hopelessly divided, irredeemably flawed, and perhaps even in terminal decline. Public polling reflects this pervasive frustration, pessimism, and enmity. If someone halfway around the world only followed the polls, he might be forgiven for believing a republic is all but over. But something remarkable is happening during the 2026 World Cup, which is jointly hosted by the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Fans from all across the world have arrived in America, and they are absolutely loving it. We too often take our way of life for granted, but many soccer tourists now here cannot stop marveling at what they see. The unlikely symbol of this phenomenon is Freddy, a young German soccer fan who has become an internet sensation while documenting his first road trip across the United States. Freddie's viral social media posts have attracted tens of millions of impressions because they reflect something both rare and refreshing, genuine, boy-like wonder. As he has crisscrossed the American South, Freddie has gushed at everything from Waffle House and Taco Bell to Buc-ee's, Bass Pro Shops, sprawling football stadiums, and the impressive size of regular, middle-class American homes. Americans, accustomed to taking all these things for granted, have watched with glee as a slack-jawed foreign visitor experiences it all for the first time. But Freddie the German is finally alone. Scores of other World Cup visitors from Europe, Asia, and elsewhere have flooded social media with similar observations. They have wandered through Walmart and Costco as if they were touring cultural landmarks. They have posted videos about yellow school buses, small-town diners, Texas barbecue, oversized grocery stores, and the sheer abundance and variety that characterize everyday life in the most prosperous country on planet Earth. Elsa the Swede has fallen in love with ranch dressing, and even the Transportation Security Administration took notice, posting on social media, quote, "If you're visiting for a very large sporting event and you happen to discover ranch, that is ranch dressing, while you're here, please pack it in your checked bag on the way home," unquote. These reactions, bursting with youthful exuberance, are amusing. But they also point toward a profound insight. Sometimes it takes an outsider to recognize what insiders can no longer see. The average American rarely pauses to consider how extraordinary our country remains today. We gripe about suburban sprawl, while living in homes that would be considered luxurious by the standards of much of the world. We roll our eyes at chain restaurants that millions of foreign tourists eagerly seek out. We treat abundance as ordinary because abundance is all most of us have ever known. That familiarity breeds a certain blindness. But the World Cup tourists are not blind. They see an America that remains dynamic, entrepreneurial, and welcoming. They encounter strangers eager to offer travel advice. They find communities proud to share local traditions. They discover a country that is far friendlier than the caricatures would suggest. The Americans they are experiencing bear little resemblance to the negative stereotypes that had long imbibed, or they had long imbibed, back home. America, like every country, has problems. the risk of prolonged decline is very real. Patriotism does not require pretending that everything is perfect, but it does require perspective, and above all, gratitude. As we approach our long-awaited America 250 celebration next weekend, Americans would do well to remember that ours remains the most successful experiment in Republican self-governance in human history. The United States is still the world's leading economic, military, and cultural power. And most importantly, as we prepare to celebrate the immortal words of 1776, it remains a nation founded upon timeless truths about human nature and human dignity. That last point matters. Our republic is founded on the biblically rooted proposition that human beings possess God-given rights, and that legitimate government exists to secure those rights and advance the common good. In other words, America is great because America is good. Not perfect, not above reproach, but fundamentally good. We see that goodness reflected in the generosity that has met so many awestruck foreigners visiting during the World Cup. It's reflected in the spirit that built the businesses, attractions, and communities, now spellbinding them. The foreign visitors who are spending this summer discovering America have unintentionally delivered an important message to those privileged enough to call this great land home. They've reminded us that our country remains worthy of admiration. They've reminded us that gratitude is often more appropriate, as it is here, than despair. As we prepare to celebrate America's 250th birthday, that lesson could not be timelier. There are plenty of reasons for concern, but there is also still reason to hope. The world still sees something special, and in the land of the free and the home of the brave, we Americans should see it, too. Very good articles from WorldNet Daily by Josh Hammer. World Cup tourists see what too many Americans have forgotten. And this was published June 26th of this year, 2026. Now, just to give a little different topic, here's something to do with health and a little warning. Several weeks ago, I mentioned some tick-borne illnesses. I don't think this one was on the list, and it is a very important one. I get this article from Fox News, June 29th, 2026, and it's by Chloe Quill of Fox News. This is the title, Rare Tick-Borne Virus Turns Deadly Fast as U.S. Cases Reach Record High, Experts Warn. Again, this was June 29th, 2026. A rare and potentially fatal tick-borne illness currently spreading across the United States can be traced back to a getting over a little head cold, not a very severe one, but I apologize if I have to interrupt with this little coughing every now and then. So let me start that sentence again. A rare and potentially fatal tick-borne illness currently spreading across the USA can be traced back to a 1958 case involving a young boy on a farm. The disease, known as, and I think you pronounce it, powassan, P-O-W-A-S-S-A-N. The disease known as powassan virus was named for the Ontario town near where it was first discovered. Excuse me. At the time of his death, Lincoln Byers, a 4-year-old living in Canada, had a condition that medical professionals could not explain, the Boston Globe reported. Years later, researchers discovered a tick harboring the same virus on a dead squirrel, finally providing an answer to the tragedy, but foreshadowing a growing public health challenge. While once considered an obscure medical anomaly, powassan virus cases have reached historic highs in the U.S., data show. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 76 Americans were diagnosed with the virus in the year 2025, the highest annual total on record. Previously, the U.S. averaged just 7 to 8 cases diagnosed each year. The virus was primarily transmitted to humans through the bite of an infected woodchuck tick or deer tick. Like other tick-borne illnesses, powassan is mostly prevalent from late spring through mid-fall when tick populations peak and outdoor activity increases. Public health experts warn that the virus's transmission speed makes it uniquely dangerous, said Dr. George P. Parada, who's a medical advisor at the National Pest Management Association in Chicago. Quote, "One of the most dangerous aspects is its rapid transmission," unquote. And he went on to say, powassan can be transmitted in as little as 15 minutes after the infected tick bites. In way of contrast, Lyme disease usually requires a 36 to 48-hour attachment time in order for transmission to occur. And Dr. Parada noted that while powassan remains rare compared to Lyme disease, it poses clinical concerns. Dr. Mark Siegel, senior medical analyst for Fox News, confirmed that the virus transmits significantly faster than Lyme disease. He noted that powassan carries an incubation period of 1 to 4 weeks before symptoms manifest. Initial symptoms include fever, headache, vomiting, and weakness, though some infected individuals remain asymptomatic, according to the CDC. The virus can progress to severe neurological complications, including encephalitis, that is inflammation of the brain, and meningitis, inflammation of the spinal cord membranes. In severe cases, patients experience confusion, loss of coordination, difficulty speaking, and seizures, according to the CDC. Approximately 10% of powassan cases involve severe neurological diseases. Approximately 10% of powassan cases involving severe neurological disease are fatal, and many survivors experience long-term neurological issues. There are currently no specific medications or vaccines to treat or prevent powassan virus. Clinical care is limited to supportive therapy, such as intravenous fluids and respiratory support. While anyone can develop severe illness, those at the highest risk include children, older adults, and immunocompromised individuals, experts caution. So that, again, was from Fox News, dated June 29, 2026. And it was by Chloe Quill. And the title, once again, if you want to look it up and reread those details, Rare Tick-Borne Virus Turns Deadly Fast, etc. Something to be on the lookout for. This is the time. I have a bunch of trees in my yard. I'm just out talking to a fellow mowing the grass, and I thought to myself, I better check the ticks when I come back in. Sometimes they'll jump down on you from the trees. All the deer tricks, ticks will sometimes come up at you from the grass. And then there are those ticks. I know several people personally that have been bitten by ticks and cannot eat red meat. It makes them sick. And that's one of those outcomes. And I can't remember the name of the tick that causes that, but I'm sure if you look in the internet, you can find it. So when you go outdoors, it's wonderful to be out in the open air. But this is one of those things in the summertime you have to watch out for. And I'm in a rural area, so the fact that I personally know several people that have this condition caused by a tick bite means it must be pretty common. All right, now, this is a Christian-oriented program. And so here we have something, good news about a revival taking place. This is from the Western Journal, and the title reads, "It's Happening. California Revival Extends for Weeks." And, quote, "Greatest Nights," unquote, "in over 50 years of evangelist crusades." This is in the Western Journal by Randy DeSoto, June 29th, 2026. Truth evangelist Mario Murillo has been preaching since the Jesus People movement in the 1960s. And he said his ministry just experienced the greatest nights of his long career. It happened in Stockton, California, where what was to be a four-night crusade extended into 4 weeks. Murillo said in a statement to the Western Journal, quote, "From our vantage point, these were the greatest nights of our 10th crusade history," unquote. In a Facebook post last week, the ministry wrote, "Night after night, hundreds responded to the gospel and gave their lives to Christ, and the healing power of God moved through the crowd in remarkable ways, touching people with all manner of sickness and disease. All glory belongs to Him," unquote. In a blog post, Larry Rutledge, with Murillo's team, wrote following the last day of the crusade on June 18th, quote, "For 52 days, a tent set on the property in Stockton, a city of a lot of people had ridden off, and on the final night, the crowd was the largest of the extended run," unquote. The audience was filled with young people from Generation Z and others of all ages. And the author, again, is Randy DeSoto, who says this, "As I read about in the new edition of my book, we hold these truths, the two beliefs that still hold the power to transform the nation and the world. America appears to be in the midst of a revival, which many are praying will lead to a reformation in culture and government." In April, Barna polling revealed that 66% of Americans said they had made a personal commitment to Jesus, which marked a 12% increase since 2021. The population of America in 2025 was 342 million, meaning there were apparently about 40 million new believers. Barna said, quote, "This shift is not only statistically significant, it may be the clearest indication of meaningful spiritual renewal in the United States," unquote. And Gen Z is leading the resurgence in church attendance, averaging twice per month, the highest of any of the generations in the U.S., according to Barna. Murillo told the thousands gathered at his final 10 meeting in Stockton last week, quote, "You are the miracle that America needs right now," unquote. People clapped and cheered in response. And some called out, "Preach," as a pianist played revival style in the background. And Mr. Murillo added, "Ladies and gentlemen, what I'm going to tell you next is so important, I've waited I don't know how many years to get to this. Do you know what it's like when God takes matters into His own hands? He did it during the Revolutionary War. We had a great awakening that none of the churches wanted," unquote. And he went on, "In an awakening, God pours His Spirit out on the secular community without the church's permission. It's happened several times." Murillo offered the example of the church's founding in Jerusalem after Jesus' resurrection. It came despite the religious leaders of the times' desires for the status quo. And Mr. Murillo argued, quote, "God is pouring out His Spirit." And he said, "That's the reason thousands are coming to His tent revival meetings." Mr. Murillo made a prayer at the end of the meeting, quote, "God save America by millions of young people coming out of the hell holes, coming out of the darkness, that don't even know who they are or why they feel the way they do. Let them rise up and silence CNN, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the cultural political establishment," unquote. And the evangelist concluded that, quote, "20 years from now, if Jesus tarries, they're going to remember the 52 days that this tent set on this property," unquote. Again, the author of the article, was Randy DeSoto, and he says, I've attended multiple crusades, including in Hanford, California, Phoenix, Arizona, and Colorado Springs, Colorado. As I write about in my book at the tent meeting in Hanford in 2022, there was a live filming of the Christian commentary show Flashpoint, during which the panelists spoke on the importance of America experiencing both a revival and a reformation. Murillo said, quote, there are two things that God is doing. One is in the body of Christ, that is the church, and another is in the community of the mountains of influence, the political, business community, education, entertainment, the Christians that are in the world, or in that world, unquote. He argued that the two streams must come together to impact culture, those inside and those outside the church. Murillo and fellow panelist Lance Wallnau put their money and time where their mouth was in 2024, hitting the seven key swing states, including Arizona, with tent meetings aimed at not just revival, but also reformation. The purpose of the meetings was to unify and to activate Christians to get involved in the 2024 election cycle. And their work, along with Charlie Kirk's Turning Point USA and many others, helped carry Donald Trump to a seven-state sweep. And that victory brought reformation in policies regarding the recognition that there are just two genders, which the Bible affirms, not to mention border security, pro-growth capitalist economic policies, and greater freedom of speech and religion. Those past tent meetings that I attended were powerful, so it is more than encouraging to see that Mr. Murillo's crusades are only growing in power and influence. And that article appeared in the Western Journal on June 29th, 2026, by Randy DeSoto. Again, the title was, It's Happening, California Revival Extends for Weeks, etc. Once again, I'm Lou Caverly. You're listening to the Divided Kingdom radio show. You can write to me, Lou Caverly, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. And this program is supported by those of you who send an occasional donation, contributions. Without your help, the program would die because I simply don't have the funds anymore to keep it going myself. There was a time when my late wife, Elizabeth, and I pretty much paid for the program completely on our own. In the late years, thankfully, many fine people have helped us out and have pretty much paid the whole cost of the program. Most months it's cost $600 to keep the program on the air. And for those like July of this year that have five Thursdays, cost an extra $100 for that extra week. So it's $700. So it isn't something that I can just contribute the money on my own. I need your help. And if you can help us, please write Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. You can hear the show Thursday evenings. Many of you still have shortwave radios. You can hear it on a frequency of 4.840 at 8 o'clock in the evening, Eastern Time. You can also go to WWCR.com, Worldwide Christian Radio, and hear the program live on their internet website. That's WWCR.com, 8 o'clock, Thursday evenings, Eastern Time. The program repeats on Saturday morning at 8 a.m. And the frequency then, if you use shortwave, is 7490 at the 7.490 megahertz. I'm dating myself when I say megacycles. That was what they called them when I was a kid. Then they renamed it in honor of a famous scientist and inventor who helped perfect radio waves, Heinrich Hertz. So now they're called megahertz. So Saturday morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, 7.490 megahertz. And again, you can hear it on WWCR.com out of Nashville, Tennessee. Worldwide Christian Radio. And there are some other ways. If you go to my website, which is DividedKingdomRadio.com, DividedKingdomRadio.com, and scroll down, you'll see a nice tribute that's still there to my late wife, Elizabeth, who passed away, sad to say, a little more than a year ago. Many of you remember Elizabeth well, and I really miss her every day. And I've lost my whole train of thought now. Oh, you can see the other venues that you can go to, like kstartalkradio.com. Now, the times may not be the same, so you'll want to check those if you search in the internet and go to the DividedKingdomRadio.com. You can see those other ways to listen to the program. Well, what else do we have to talk about? We've talked a little bit about AI. You hear AI talked about all the time. You can hardly turn on the TV set without hearing about AI in some respect. Some people say it's going to be the panacea, the most wonderful thing you can imagine. It'll end diseases. It'll do all kinds of things. And there's something to be said for that. Others say it's going to take over. Like the computer in the movie some of you may have seen, 2001 A Space Odyssey. It's going to put us all out of business, make us all paupers. Well, here's one real-life situation. This appeared on Fox News, and the title says, Ford, Ford Motor Company, that is, Ford rehires experienced engineers after AI misses the mark. This is by Eric Rebell of Fox Business. And I don't have a date, but I got this just a day or two ago, possibly even today. I'm recording this on the last day of June. So if you go to Fox News, you can certainly find this article. All right, what's it say? Ford has rehired experienced human engineers to help address the shortcomings of artificial intelligence, AI, tools meant to tackle quality issues in the automaker's production processes. The hiring push helped Ford top the J.D. Power 2026 U.S. Initial Quality Study, or IQS. For the first time since 2010, amid improvements in the quality of its new vehicles, and it follows some hard-learned lessons about the ability of AI to replace human knowledge in production processes. Charlie Poon, Ford's Vice President of Vehicle Hardware, stated, "Artificial intelligence is a fantastic tool, but it's only as good as the information you use to train it." And he said that on a press call Wednesday. This would be Wednesday of last week, according to a report by Bloomberg. And he went on to say, "Over prior years, we didn't pay as much attention as we should have to the experience of our most knowledgeable engineers that have been with us through many product cycles." He went on to say, "Mistakenly, we thought that by just introducing artificial intelligence and ingesting the design requirements that we had, that would produce a high-quality product." And those are the words again of, I'll check his name again, Charles Poon, P-O-O-N, Ford Vice President of Vehicle Hardware Engineering. He also noted that the AI tools lack the training and expertise that veteran technicians have, and many of the company's veteran technicians left Ford before their knowledge could be used to improve the performance of the AI tools. Poon also said, "We recognize that for us to enhance some of our automation and machine learning and artificial intelligence tools, we needed to ensure that they were trained by the most experienced individuals," unquote. The Detroit giant said that it has hired about 300 veteran engineers to work in the vehicle engineering division in the last few years. And Ford said in a release, quote, "Free from daily production schedules, those engineers now act as internal auditors, running mandatory weekly design reviews to hunt for and eliminate potential failure points before blueprints ever reach the factory floor, unquote. For Chief Operating Officer, Kumar Galhotra, said that the experienced engineers and technical specialists were at the heart of the company's efforts to improve production quality by addressing process issues before they're incorporated into workflows. And Ford CEO Jim Farley told Bloomberg TV that the shift is helping improve the company's financial performance, with spending on warranty coverage and recalls decreasing, which in turn is boosting the automaker through cost reductions. J.D. Power's 2026 IQS, and again, what that stands for? Initial quality study. So J.D. Power's 2026 initial quality study not only placed Ford at the top of the list for the first time in 16 years, but it also ranked the Ford F-150, Ford Mustang, and Ford Super Duty at the top of their respective segments for the second straight year. Additionally, the Ford Escape, Ford Explorer, Ford Expedition, and Ford Maverick also ranked among the top three in their segments, which meant that seven of the company's top 10 models ranked in the top three for their categories. Okay, so that was from Fox News. Ford rehires experienced engineers after AI misses the mark, by Eric Revell. And again, I don't have the date, but it's certainly either June 28th, 29th, or 30th. It shouldn't be hard to find if you'd like to keep a copy of it. What else do we have? Getting back to a Christian, or at least a Judeo-Christian story. This also is from Fox News by Kelly McGreal, June 28th. Rare American Bible and Founders Letter, Trace Faith's Role and Birth of the Nation. I'll just interject here. If you go back and look in detail at the history, much more so than will be found in a typical American history textbook, you'll find that the founding fathers and mothers relied upon the Bible and the Judeo-Christian heritage much more than you would ever think from what you hear on the news. The Mayflower Compact, for example, begins with the words, "In the name of God, amen." And as you may or may not read in American history textbooks, the Pilgrim fathers and mothers came to the country seeking religious freedom. They left England and went to Holland for that very reason. They were being persecuted for their religious fervor and their refusal to bend the knee to the Anglican Church of England in the early 1600s. Now, it's true that by 1620 or 1619, I think 1620, they were realizing that their children were losing their heritage. Even though the Dutch had made them welcome, there were a lot of drawbacks. And that's one of the key reasons they left. But the main reason was the religious reason, that they wanted to be able to practice their faith with freedom. So getting to this article now, again, published June 28th, a rare collection of original letters, family Bibles, and founding-era artifacts is offering new insight into the role Scripture played during the nation's founding. The artifacts are on display at the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C., where a new collection marking America's 250th anniversary examines how Scripture influenced the country's earliest years through original documents and historical objects. Among the featured items are the first Bible printed in English in America, family Bibles belonging to several founding fathers and other prominent Americans, and an original Thomas Jefferson letter on religious freedom. Together, the documents trace how biblical language appeared throughout the founding era, influencing conversations about liberty, education, and public life. And I'll just interject here, if you look at Abraham Lincoln, at his second inaugural address, he at least three times quotes from the Bible. And that's not a long speech. It can easily fit on two sheets of typewritten paper. So the fact that he quotes it three times in that short speech is, I think, very significant. You can find that. Just type in Abraham Lincoln, second inaugural address, and you'll quickly see the entire speech. And if you know the Bible, you'll quickly realize those three quotations. Now, getting back to the article, Anthony Schmidt, the museum's director of collections and curator, told Fox News Digital that the collection uses primary sources to examine the Bible's role in early American history. He said, quote, "The Bible has been an integral part of this nation's founding and history. That's not a theological claim. It's what the documents show. The founding fathers referenced scripture, argued from it, and built political frameworks on its language about human dignity and liberty," unquote. One section explores how scripture was part of everyday life during the nation's earliest years, displaying the first Bible printed in English in America, alongside family Bibles owned by several founding fathers and other historical figures. Schmidt said the objects were intentionally selected to tell what he described as the fullest story possible about the Bible's influence on America's founding generation. These objects, and again this is a direct quote from Mr. Schmidt, "These objects show the Bible's impact not only on religious life, but on early American art, education, and politics," unquote. Another section examines the relationship between faith and government through Jefferson's writings on religious liberty and one of the nation's earliest published arguments for resisting tyranny. Visitors can also review Revolutionary Era printed materials that helped unify the colonies, documents tracing early Jewish civic life in America, portraits of George Washington and other colonial era figures, a hand-colored lithograph memorializing Abraham Lincoln, and busts of George Washington and Benjamin Franklin. Schmidt said one of the collection's central goals is to encourage visitors to engage directly with original historical documents. And he said, "We want visitors to encounter the history of this country and see in the primary documents what impact the Bible actually had on the people who built it," he said. He noted that while the founding fathers often disagreed on matters of religion, the historic record shows many were still influenced by the Bible's language and ideas. And Schmidt concluded, "Many of the founders disagreed about religion and disagreed sharply, but they were still shaped by the Bible's language and arguments. We want people to engage with that evidence and come to their own conclusions," unquote. And again, that was from Fox News. The title, "Rare American Bible and Founders' Letters Trace Faith's Role in Birth of the Nation," by Kelly McGreal, June 28th. And I'll add, it's very important to get back to the primary documents. Any good library will have books that go into much more detail than your typical high school American history book. And they will have quotations from the founding fathers, from the pilgrims, from those who settled in Virginia, from the Quakers of Pennsylvania, and on down through the generations, right up through the American Revolution, and on, right up to the time of Lincoln. And it's good to go back to these, what they call the primary documents, secondary being books written using those, but not the actual original documents. Get a hold of those sometimes. Go to any good library, public library, college library, and you'll be able to find plenty of examples of those that give you the actual quotes. So you can see, because all too often the news media distort things and make it sound like this nation was founded by a bunch of deists who hardly even believed in God. Well, there were some deists. Jefferson was probably one. I don't know about Washington. I have to admit I haven't studied them that much. But there were others who were devout Christians and who weren't afraid to say so. So check that out when you get a chance. Okay, to switch gears a little bit, here's something that caught my eye. I don't fly much anymore. There was a time when I would fly from the D.C. area or Baltimore up to Boston to visit my parents when I was very young. And I enjoyed flying then. But, of course, it wasn't as complicated. Oh, I mean, the 9/11 tragedy, things were tightened up a great deal. And I'm glad that they were. Well, there's a new threat, and one that's going to be, I think, kind of hard to defend against. That's drones. Here's a little short article that appeared in Zero Hedge. Quote, right above the cockpit, unquote, drone strikes JetBlue plane on final approach to JFK Airport. This is by Tyler Durden, again from Zero Hedge, June 30th, 2026. JetBlue Airways Flight 948 reportedly struck a small drone while the narrow-body aircraft was in the traffic pattern on final approach to John F. Kennedy Airport in New York City. A JetBlue pilot could be heard talking with Kennedy Tower about the drone strike. The pilot said the jet collided with a drone during a turn about 2 miles before landing. When the controller asked for confirmation, the pilot said the object struck, quote, right above the cockpit, unquote. And the pilot said, just quickly, I couldn't talk to approach, but we collided with a drone back there in the turn. The air traffic controller asked, you said you collided? The pilot said, yep, it hit us right above the cockpit, unquote. The FAA released a statement shortly after the midair incident. The pilot of JetBlue Airlines, and I think this is a statement from FAA, Federal Aviation Administration, the pilot of JetBlue Airlines, Flight 948, reported striking a drone at approximately 3,000 feet altitude while on final approach to John F. Kennedy International Airport around 7:15 a.m. local time on Monday, June 29th. A post-flight inspection did not reveal any damage to the aircraft. The FAA will investigate. Contact your airline for more information. So that was the FAA statement. The incident is yet another warning that even some of those heavily monitored and defended airspaces in the country remain highly exposed to small, low-cost drones. It also underscores the urgent need for counter-UAS deployments at major airports and other critical infrastructure nodes, including power grids and data centers, before a devastating drone attack becomes a national story across every front page. That's a sobering article. I'm sure I'd want to fly right now, even if I had a place to go to. That was from Zero Hedge by Tyler Durden, June 30th, 2026. Well, we have a little less than 10 minutes to go. We've got a couple more articles. As most of you know, I'm originally from the greater Boston area, a little small town, about 25 miles north of Boston, not too far from historic Salem, Gloucester, that section that natives call the North Shore of Boston. So here's something that caught my eye. This is also from Fox News, one of the biggest myths about the Boston Tea Party revealed by historian. And this is by Andrea Margolis, who always says good articles for Fox News. June 30th, 2026. Bruce Richardson, founder of Elmwood Inn Fine Teas, says green tea was as popular as black tea in colonial America. When Americans think of the beverage that fueled the American Revolution, they usually picture black tea. But it turns out that green tea was just as popular. The founding fathers and their contemporaries drank both types of tea. Bruce Richardson, the Kentucky-based founder of Elmwood Inn Fine Teas, told Fox News Digital, British subjects were as likely to be drinking green tea as black tea. whether you were in Jane Austen era England, England, or you were in colonial Boston, he added. Richardson said there were five teas, all from China, because that was the only country that was exporting tea. And of those five different teas, two of them were green, and three of them were black. Richardson, a tea historian who works as a tea master at the Boston Tea Party Ships and Museum, said the five types of tea dumped in Boston Harbor in protest of the Tea Act of 1773 included three black varieties, Bohea, Souchong, and Congou, or Congou, as well as the green teas, Tyson and Singlo. Now, let me skip down a little bit because we're getting short on time. It says Bohea was the most common type and the least expensive type of black tea of that era. And it was the one most dumped into Boston Harbor. And Mr. Richardson said it was so common that often teapots at the time, or some that I've seen, would say Bohea on the side of the teapot. And if they wanted tea, they'd say, I'll have a cup of Bohea. By the way, that's spelled B-O-H-E-A. And it was that common. And they even stored the teas differently. I'm skipping down and condensing this a little bit now. The well-to-do people would have a tea caddy, a wooden, beautifully made tea caddy, to store their tea in. And it would have two compartments, one for the green tea, one for the black. And the black tea held up better on the long voyage from China to Europe and onward to the American colonies. But they drank both kinds. It says the green tea was what Chinese folks had always drunk. And so they were exporting that as well. But they found that the black tea actually made the voyage better than the green tea. Now, of course, after the Boston Tea Party, a lot of the patriots decided they weren't going to drink any British tea, although, of course, it really came from China. And so they made their own kind of Liberty teas from such things as dried apples, blueberries, chamomile, and herbs grown in their gardens. Richardson said they still wanted their tea time, but they didn't want to support the British government. Ah, that's an interesting little article from Fox News entitled One of the Biggest Myths About the Boston Tea Party Revealed by Historian by Andrea Margolis, June 30th, 2026. And, okay, that pretty much runs through the articles that I have. There was one more. For that, I've got to go over and get my computer. So stay with me for a minute. Because I didn't have time to print this one out, but I have it stored on my computer. So if you'll bear with me for just a second, I will bring it up. It has to do with college loans. And a lot of my friends, fortunately, have paid off their college loans. I had a dear friend, actually a girlfriend, before I met my wife, Elizabeth, and she was saddled years and years ago, we're talking now 50 years ago, with college loans. But nowadays, some of the amount owed by these people are just incredible. Yes, now we've got the article here. This is from the Wall Street Journal, June 29th, 2026. The title, they're in their 60s and their student loans won't let them retire. There's some pictures of various people, too. Okay, has a quick summary, which says more than 3 million people, 62 and older, owe federal student loans, an increase from 1.8 million in 2018. And to give one example, I'll read as much as time permits here. Chris and Carolyn McAuliffe are in their 60s, but don't expect to retire anytime soon. They are still paying off their student loan debt, which has ballooned to $500,000. Now, this is a little speaking. I can't conceive of that. My house If I sold my house, I wouldn't have the money to pay that off. Just incredible. And Chris, an engineer for a health insurance company, says, quote, "I regret going to college," unquote. When they earned their graduate degrees decades ago, the couple owned a combined $114,000 in student loans. With stable careers, Carolyn in nursing, they stayed on top of their monthly payments. When they bought a house and had two children, money got tight. So they consolidated their loans and opted for a payment plan that lowered their monthly bill. That extended the life of the loan, and compounding interest charges kept pushing up their balance. Student loans are increasingly following Americans into their 60s and rewriting what they believe would be their retirement years. More than 3 million people, 62 and older, owe federal student loans, up from 1.8 million in 2018. And I see our time is running out. I may have to read more of this at a later time. I see this says federal loans. I don't know about private bank loans. Maybe it says something about that a little lower down. Delinquency, now back to the article, delinquency rates among older borrowers has skyrocketed too. In some cases, because they are on fixed incomes or have medical expenses. Those who fall into default risk having their Social Security benefits, tax refunds, and wages garnished. That is a shocking thing. This is a lengthy article. Again, let me give you the source in case you want to track this down. This is in the Wall Street Journal. The title was, "They're in their 60s and their student loans won't let them retire," by, I guess you pronounce it, Oyin Adedoyin. Well, I have to give his name, or her name, whichever it is, at a later time. It appears June 29th, just a few days back, June 29th, 2026, Wall Street Journal. Well, I hope you have a good 4th of July. Keep in mind some of the things we've said. Honor this country. It is the greatest country on earth, in spite of faults. And it was designed that way by men and women who knew what to do to keep the country going. So thank you for listening. Have a wonderful week ahead. Good night.